from St. Louis Public Radio. This is Politically Speaking. Bill Hardwick has spent his professional life as a soldier and a lawyer, and for the last 6 years, he served as a member of the Missouri State House. Now he wants to make a transition to the state Senate by representing the 16th Senatorial District. Hardwick joins us on the latest episode of Politically Speaking to talk about the hotly contested Republican primary. Let's hit the music.
This is the Politically Speaking podcast, the definitive show about Missouri politics.
Let's go back to some of those policies, to that peace and prosperity that we had some 4 to 5 years ago.
Everywhere is Democratic country once this Democrat's been there.
There are a lot of things in Washington that are very bipartisan, including some bills that I've already gotten passed.
And I think it works best when you can see both sides, but you have to pick one, and I firmly align with the Republicans.
But certainly, I think if she's running against one of the crazy dudes, certainly it's going to be a lot easier.
But I'll take wisdom and age and a few missteps in oral over somebody who has no substance.
I believe that you represent the party's values and you move forward, and that's what I have done.
And welcome to Politically Speaking. I am your host, St. Louis Public Radio's politics correspondent, Jason Rosenbaum. I'm recording from the St. Louis Public Radio Richmond Heights Bureau, and joining me from St. Louis Public Radio's Rolla Bureau, he is Rolla correspondent for St. Louis Public Radio.
I'm Jonathan Ohl.
And joining us in studio, he is one of three major candidates running in the Republican primary for Missouri's 16th District Senate seat.
Bill Hardwick.
Thank you so much for joining us again. And before we ask you about why you've decided to run for this seat, I guess a basic question is, what are the counties that make up the 16th Senatorial District?
The 16th Senatorial District in Missouri is six counties: Marys County, Phelps County, Dent County, Pulaski County, Laclede County, and Wright County. It's about 180,000 people right here in South Central Missouri. So it's, you know, south of Jeff City, about halfway between Springfield and St. Louis is this district. It encompasses a large area between those two cities.
Even though we've had you on the podcast before, tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got involved in Missouri politics.
Missouri politics. Okay. Born here in Rolla, at the hospital here in Rolla. Went to Dixon School, the public school, Dixon High School. Dad was a construction worker, union. My mom cleaned houses. She worked for Missouri Home Care. She had a bunch of jobs, you know, medical jobs, stuff like that. Eventually became a teacher. To pay for college, I joined the Missouri National Guard, joined the military, went to basic training, served, did that, got my degree, became an officer, became an engineer officer, served a tour overseas, came back, and went to law school, started practice law, was a prosecutor. And my conclusion, being in the military, being overseas, and being a lawyer, was that the laws were kind of messed up, and that if you really wanted to solve problems, you had to go to where the place the people were solving problems were, and that's politics. So whether you're in the medical field, or you're a lawyer, or you're a farmer, or you're a construction worker, or you're a teacher, or you're whatever you are, there is some politician somewhere debating about what you can and can't do. So that really seemed like the place for me to go if I wanted to affect change. And also just, you know, my whole life, I'm kind of a dichotomous personality. I'm introverted in the sense that I kind of like to read and kind of nerd out on stuff, but I also just love talking to people and listening to people's story and listening about people and helping people. And so I've got a business that fits that perfect, you know, a line of work, I mean, that fits that perfectly, where I can just really drill down and analyze these subjects in detail, really complex, really abstract problems. And then I can also, it's a people business, I can deal with people, help them solve problems, and try to apply these ethereal concepts to real people's lives. That's my kind of draw to politics.
Representative, I as a proud resident of Rolla, I see a lot of ads in this race.
Yes.
And one of them of yours that I saw was of you firing a couple weapons.
Yes.
And you and everyone in this race have made a point of talking about how much you are going to protect Second Amendment rights. So I know you're talking to a lot of people in the district. more than I do, for sure. But the people that I talk to and I'm asking what their concerns are, the thing that keeps coming up is how expensive things are,
mm-hmm.
specifically energy and healthcare. And are we going to have proper schools and healthcare in a rural area? And those are things that the state government does have a big ability to affect in all of those areas. So when you hear those, are you hearing those concerns? And when you do, what do you say about those?
Yes, that everything is expensive, and it seems like middle income or lower income people are just being crushed by the economic status quo. That comes up everywhere. Healthcare, not just the cost of healthcare, but the way people are treated in the healthcare system. Mm-hmm. That there is a treatment that could be available, but it's impossible to find a specialist. That you don't know what's being written in the healthcare notes. That people feel like they've lost their agency as human beings. That issue comes up a lot. Energy costs are going up. We talk about that. You know, for everything, price, and I guess I'll make this note, price is created by, it's formulated by the production cost of something and then the equilibrium price, supply and demand, right? Mm-hmm. So to me, the real way to deal with prices is to have more competition, is to have to produce more of something. Like we want more healthcare providers. We want more opportunity to reach healthcare. We want the ability to invent new medical devices and imaging devices to make its way to Rolla. And the more of that that's available, that means the more people have options, and that curtails the price growth, but it also means people have a better experience in theory. So to me, the one solution, not the only solution, but one solution to how prices are out of control is, you know, classical economics, competition, but also not the government creating monopolies, not the government creating a choke point, a throughput issue for the provision of those things to people. So we talk about that. But we also want to talk about, okay, we want to remove barriers to people being able to get access to healthcare. Sometimes that's telehealth. Sometimes that's the availability of specialists. Sometimes that's government rules that, or even corporate rules that prevent doctors from, specialists from being down here in Rolla. We want to remove those barriers. We want to remove barriers from people being able to pay off their credit card, from starting a business, to be able to go to college. And so, you know, that we talked about the second amendment earlier. I think that's a very important work that I've done. But I've also done a lot of work on veterans getting education benefits, on, you know, I did work on the non-competes so that if a doctor went to a big hospital, there was a chance for them to go ahead, come down to Rolla, come down to rural Missouri, right? Bring more doctors to rural Missouri. So I've got legislative work that addresses that specifically, addresses costs where there's a double tax on utilities for hotels and the tourism industry in St. Robert. So those issues are things that I've tried to meaningfully address. And I think you're right. I think that both in the Democratic and Republican parties, there are more people just feeling crushed and squeezed and not listened to. Mm-hmm. And they're really looking for somebody who's going to listen to them, but also take action on the way that their life feels like they get overwhelmed by the system.
Okay, so let me just follow up on that because you mentioned healthcare in Rolla a few times. I want to direct our attention 30 miles south of here to Salem. The Salem Hospital has been in a precarious position for years. and I don't know exactly where they stand today, but that hospital and other healthcare providers like them, we're very blessed in Rolla. We've got a really good hospital. It's right across the street from where we're sitting at the moment. But it's those healthcare facilities that, especially with more than 300,000 people getting kicked off of Missouri Medicaid this year, those rural hospitals need Medicaid to be able to survive. So what is the answer to try to make sure that there are healthcare providers, not just in Rolla, but that we're not going to make people drive from Salem or Houston to Rolla to get health care because their medical provider can't make it anymore?
Yeah, those are good questions, but they're good because they're also countervailing winds. So, for example, we had the issue of 340B about whether or not the drug companies had to build in that discount. And that discount by law, by federal law, has to be passed on to consumers. So hospitals really wanted that. Pharmaceutical companies didn't. I came down on the side of the hospitals, Rolla, Salem, our local healthcare providers. Things we could do like that to take advantage of cost savings for the hospital to stay in business because access is so important. I want to do that. Medicaid is important. I think that we need to have the FRA reimbursement for Medicaid. I voted for that. You know, people, this kind of makes people scratch their head because I'm viewed as such a hardcore conservative. But for things like that, access to healthcare, you know, I've been supportive of that, especially if it's taking advantage of federal spend down. I'm kind of a preventative medicine guy too. I think that Medicaid should cover chiropractic services. I think it should cover services that help kind of maintain your health so there's not a major surgery or a catastrophic issue down the road. But I do think that Medicaid should not be available to everybody in the state, because if we talk about our budgetary issues, there has to be a point at which people are sort of making their way off Medicaid, able to have, we help them have bigger incomes, start a business, be successful. So I don't think 6 million Missourians should be on Medicaid, but I think we should prioritize Medicaid, especially for disabled children, especially for lower income individuals, especially for individuals with disabilities, and make sure that those services cover what people need, including things that I think save us cost down the road, like chiropractic services. When they said, you know, Medicaid doesn't cover that anymore, I thought that doesn't make sense. You know, if people go to the chiropractor longer, they're going to, you know, they might have less need of for a back surgery later on, right? So stuff like that, I think we should just do things that make sense. I, you know, some people who agree with me on conservatism disagree, and they think that there should be no Medicaid. I think we should have Medicaid. I think we should prioritize it. I think we should keep it solvent. I think we should take advantage of what federal matches are on the table. But I don't think we should expand it to the general population and go down that road, because eventually that'll mean a budget crisis for our state, and that'll mean all kinds of services people rely on aren't available. So, I mean, that's kind of my general take. So when the Rolla Hospital or healthcare providers in Salem or in St. Robert or Lebanon, they come talk to me, they talk about wanting to take advantage of drawing down federal funds. And I've always been trying to be helpful to them, being able to work with CMS to draw that down. Or they say, here's a necessary cost driver that's, you know, there's a necessary barrier to us having doctors, having hiring, like the non-competes. So I've tried to file bills to address that when I heard that and do what I can to make both the providers stay in business longer and then have more people in rural Missouri have more access to healthcare.
You have been a proponent of legalizing and regulating video lottery terminals, which are usually found in gas stations, convenience stores, and fraternal organizations. Why have you been a proponent of this?
So several years ago, there was a split among prosecutors if a no-chance game was illegal or not. You know, the statute says that you ante in money for a game of chance or contingent upon some future event, and then there's consideration paid out. Okay, so how do I make that illegal? If I just make a no-chance game illegal, I probably made all the arcade games illegal. I probably made skee-ball illegal. Okay, by that statute's definition, a claw machine is a slot machine. It has a random number generator. You put a quarter in or whatever, you can get a prize out. It's gambling. So, you know, the different types of machines proliferated. There were clearly illegal machines that were slot machines. There were no-chance games that were arguably gray. The casinos argued that they were illegal, but some groups argued that they were legal. There were other types of devices that maybe had an element of skill in them that probably weren't illegal, but they were out there too. And there wasn't a comprehensive what's legal and what's not. It cleared to me that that required a law change. And then so you've got, you know, we don't want kids playing slot machines in gas stations. We don't want kids playing slot machines on a street corner. But we have VFWs that have basically gambling as their revenue and they're a civic organization. And I don't think, you know, as long as there's guardrails, that they're hurting anybody. The VFWs came, they made their point, the prosecutors made their point, restaurant association, talked to municipalities, the highway patrol. I tried to listen to everybody, but it was clear there should be a law change. And what I wanted to do was a fair framework for everyone. So I worked on that, and basically my bill said this year and had said that if your city wants to have gaming, they can have gaming or not. But all the illegal machines have to go away. An unlicensed slot machine has to go away. Your city can say they want to have gaming, your county can. If they do, then they have to go, then whoever wants has to apply for a license to the lottery commission, background check, no access to anybody under 21, consumer protections, maximum bet of $4, payout schedule 80-20, state regulates it, and then it's taxed like gambling. You know, that's still, to me, that still allowed the legitimate lawful businesses to go get a license, you know, come under the appropriate color of the law and to do business. And then that also made sure that the revenue, the tax revenue for gaming was collected and there was consumer protections for the public and gambling wasn't proliferating. That seemed like a really fair law to me. Most of my constituents I talked to, whether or not they had gray machines or not, They thought that was fair. That's a good solution. You know, most prosecutors I talked to, they thought that was a fair solution. In fact, the Prosecutors Association testified in favor of my bill, as did a lot of veterans groups, you know, as did some school groups, right? Because once the money goes into the lottery fund, by the Constitution, it has to go to public education. So that, I didn't think it was controversial. I thought it was a good solution to a very complex problem. Everything becomes controversial in Jefferson City because somebody makes or loses money almost on any proposition. So I did my best to try to, and I had a spreadsheet. I wish you guys could see it. I wish my constituents could see it. I had a spreadsheet. You know, one issue was like under 21 can't play. Every stakeholder agreed on that. One issue was like, okay, should you have to construct a back room? You know, these groups agreed on it, but the small time truck stops didn't agree on that, right? But the restaurant guys agreed on that. The bar guys agreed on that. The VFWs thought that was fine because it's mainly only 21 access to a bar anyway. So I had issues like, okay, what about a negotiated split? What about, you know, the assessment that goes to the county? So I tried to just have this huge spreadsheet to see what everybody would agree on. And I built a pretty large coalition. I think that's a credit to me as a lawmaker that I listen. It's complex. I want to solve it. You know, the casinos obviously did not want to negotiate. They're definitely out to make sure that I don't win the Senate race because but I wanted to negotiate with them. I tried to talk about their promo tax. I tried to talk about fees, but they were just like, hey, we're not going to talk to you. Okay, that's fine. That's where we are. And then their characterization of the subject is that Bill wants slot machines everywhere. He's the guy that's bringing degeneracy to your community. But that's not what my bill was, and that's not what my intent was. And I don't think that's an accurate characterization of my position, that I want gambling everywhere in the state. What I want is for local communities to decide what type of gaming they want. And I want it to be regulated by the Lottery Commission. And then I want it to have safeguards on it. I don't think it's feasible or a good policy to say there could be no games outside the casino license, which, by the way, the casinos do have gaming outside the casino through sports betting. And then other states, casinos control the video gaming terminals. They call them their states. The casinos are involved in that. So it's not the issue of gambling. It's the issue of who controls and who wins financially. But my point of view is I don't want to make any group win financially. I want something that I think is fair for everybody from every point of view. And when the chips fell on that, some groups were like, hey, he was great to work with. We've agreed with his position. We don't agree with all of his position. We agree with his position. You know, they supported me in the Senate race. And then some groups were like, absolutely not. And they supported, you know, other people running against me. And I think that's the way lots of issues go in Missouri politics, or have gone. It just so happens that we're at the flashpoint of this issue. But my position is not that we should have unregulated gambling in Missouri. My position is that communities need to make decisions for themselves about it, and then it needs to be regulated and have guardrails on it.
Do you think, though, that even having what you described is going to make it more likely that people are going to become addicted to gambling if they can just go to one of these machines at a gas station or convenience store rather than have to go through a casino?
No, I think that the worst risk for gambling addiction is what the casinos put on the ballot. Certain casinos, not all casinos, actually agree with that version of sports betting because it financially benefits some casinos over the others. That they put on the ballot to have sports betting where a child can bet on a phone. A 19-year-old can get on a phone and bet, and the constitutional amendment forbids the legislature from regulating it. So I can't do anything about that statutorily. So to me, there's a need for the state to get involved if you want to stop problem gaming, and at least make sure that issue is preempted by legislation. I think also that if we don't change the law, and even if the attorney general is an effort to try to say, okay, this is legal, this is not, it should have a statutory change to determine what's legal and what's not, one. But then two, then another device could be invented that has a slightly different element than the law says. Another device might have an element of chance in it. You never solve the issue of what's gray and what's not gray legally unless there's a statutory change. And this is something that I came around to, actually, because in this process, I listened to people and I changed my mind on some things. I changed other people's minds on some things. But I initially didn't want to change 572, the definition of gambling, because I thought that would criminalize too many things. But over time, as I started to study the mechanics and the technical specifications of different machines, I realized that you need to change to 572. Because Missouri's gambling law was actually too narrow, so you had to have it cover more things. And the civil court case, which is often cited to justify the attorney general's efforts, the civil court case between two vendors of no chance games, by the way. Both the parties in that case had no chance games. One just sued the other for false advertising. In that civil court case, the federal judge says there is a regulatory void because the Gaming Commission does not have the authority to regulate games that are not licensed under the gaming provisions of the Constitution, which actually means that all gambling outside the casino, there's not a regulatory structure to oversee it. So, okay, are we going to eliminate all gambling outside the casino? Well, I can't functionally do that without shutting down the VFWs, honestly. And the VFWs from Lebanon and my district and the surrounding districts came and they said, will you work with us? And I said, yes, I will work with the VFWs to give you guys a pathway to have something where you can continue to make money. I thought that was fair. I don't think I was doing anything wrong there. But in that process, some people were like, no, you have to change the law to do this and shut down the... And I was like, no, I told the VFWs I wouldn't do that. And so some people didn't like it. Some people liked it. And I gained some people's respect. But I don't... But to your question is, do I think I'm expanding gambling addiction? I don't. I think that we're putting in the guardrails for problem gaming that didn't exist before.
We'll be right back after this quick break with Politically Speaking with State Representative Bill Hardwick. And we're back on Politically Speaking with Bill Hardwick. He is one of three major candidates running for Missouri's 16th senatorial district seat. Jonathan, I'm going to turn the questioning back to you.
I'd like to talk about education funding.
Yes.
So here at Rolla High School, there was a beloved French teacher who left. And the reason that she left was because she simply could not take the salary anymore. And she ended up taking a job where she works from home for a company and a job that she probably doesn't find as rewarding, but economically she just had to. And I understand that nobody likes paying taxes. And I understand that one person is one voice in the legislature. But how do we expect high quality, good people to continue to be teachers? A really, really difficult job when we don't fully fund the education formula and we are okay being so low in state rankings in terms of teacher pay. How do we square that?
Yeah, that's the perfect question. And I do have an experience thinking through that even on the campaign trail, because here's what's like campaigning in 2026. You show up to an event or to somebody's house and they say, hey, we want to make sure we pay our teachers more. Yeah, I do too. But we have better schools, absolutely. And the police force, we got to fund them. The police aren't being paid enough. I totally agree. And the roads, they're falling apart. And will somebody ever fix I-44? And I'm like, yeah, we got to do that. And, you know, healthcare, we got to have more money to cover more things in healthcare. And I go, yeah, we do, definitely. We need better outcomes for people. And then they say, and I don't want to pay any property taxes. And I go, yeah, property taxes are the worst. You know, you own your... Whatever, something, you know, I see the principle there. And I don't want to pay any income taxes. Okay. And then I don't want my sales taxes raised. So then it puts me in a really complicated math problem. How do we fund all these services? And I think education is a big priority for services and have this kind of whack-a-mole Swiss cheese approach to our tax policy. Or just in some cases, just eliminate taxes altogether and say, we'll figure it out somehow. Economic growth will happen. I'm a proponent of funding our public schools all kinds of different ways, through a local effort, whether that's in some communities a sales tax local effort or a property tax. Property tax is pretty stable. In a county like Marys County, property tax is a lot more stable than sales tax because they have a much smaller sales tax base. Right now, we fund a part of that GR through income tax. You know, there's about $8 billion or so collected income tax in the state. And incidentally, the money that's collected from the casinos, from gambling, and the money that's collected from the lottery commission, if it's gaming taxed, all of that has to go to education. So that's like kind of the other way, right? And there's some other fees that are matching, like conservation fees for license fees. Those go to education. But I'm a proponent of multiple ways to fund education because I think that makes us more resilient to downturns of the economy or when there's a recession. You know, we can't just say all the taxes are going to be eliminated through growth because there'll be periods of regression. There'll be periods of downward economic cycle. So to me, lots of different ways is the best way to do it. Then, you know, and I don't mean to harken back to our last subject, we have to think of ways that will supplement that funding. And the bill that I had that we just talked about It had hundreds of the fiscal note was hundreds of millions of dollars for public education that couldn't be diverted elsewhere, had to go to lottery fund, had to go to education. To me, that was part of me trying to find a solution. And I think we have to, and I think gambling is a panacea, but we have to find different solutions to fund education for sure. Because I think that the education is a public trust. To every young person, we owe them to say, there's a place that's safe, that you'll have a safe environment, where you'll be equipped for the future, this ever dynamically changing future, where you'll learn how to do math and to read and to think and to have cultural exposure. Those are all good things for students. That's part of our public commitment, our social contract. So that means that, and the Constitution actually gives that burden to the legislature to fund that and to sort that out.
Okay, I hear what you're saying there, but that people want their taxes lowered and they want great services. And that is a dichotomy that you can't reconcile. I get that. But if you look at what the legislature has done in the last, you know, 6 to 10 years, they've made significant movements on half of that, you know, on one right. of those, which is reduced taxes. They have not done, and they've done it at the expense of funding things properly.
Right.
So it seems like the legislature has already decided in that dichotomy who's going to win, and that is continue to cut taxes and continue to reduce services and funding.
Yeah, and there's a little bit of madness of the crowds there, right? Because if there's an amendment that comes on, and the Senate race is a good example, there's an amendment that comes on and says, we're going to eliminate taxes for McDonald's coffee. You know, everybody goes, we love coffee. I mean, you're almost forced to, right? Because if you don't, what will happen is July of your primary, you'll have, you know, $100,000 of ads running against you that you voted to increase taxes, true or not. So there's like this political pressure to go that direction. And I think that it requires statesmanship to say, and the hard votes where you go, no, I'm just not voting to that. I'm not voting for that tax credit, because I think the ultimate person who loses is our local public school. Like, that requires a level of courage. And then we do have to think about, okay, how do we find different revenue streams? I think there's a lot of things that can be cut in the budget. The budget is a statement of your priorities. But, you know, we have to make sure that we're cutting those the projects that are necessary, the unnecessary tax credits, you know, for Hollywood, for whatever, before we get to cutting the public education budget. And I'll admit that the Republicans and the you know, the prevailing party haven't done as good a job as that as I'd like. That's also part of the reason why I'm running. In my hometown, you know, our middle school closed down. And there was years where that middle school had problems. You know, my aunt was a teacher there. You know, my son went to school there. And she talked to me about, okay, there's a problem. We need mold remediation. And I did my effort to go to the budget side and try to do things for them. You know, but I wasn't in a position where I could really problem solve and apply that, because I was a House member without a leadership role. So I kind of remember that conversation and how much that bothered me, that I didn't feel like I did enough for them. And even though, like, this is such a topsy-turvy situation, like running for Senate, that's actually a huge part of my motivation for running, is like, I'll be in a position where, like, if I apply my intelligence and creativity and, like, my strong will, I could do a lot more for them. And that's really important to me.
Let's talk about some of the things that are going to be on the ballot besides you. Okay, let's go to four. Because during the 2025 special session, I remember talking with you specifically about this proposal, and you were one of a number of Republicans that voted against putting this on the ballot.
Right.
So, number one, can you explain why? And does that mean that you will be voting no on four, which, by the way, would require any constitutional amendment that is put before voters through the initiative petition process to pass in 8 out of 8 congressional districts? And it does not apply to constitutional amendments that are put forward by the legislature. Those would still require a majority vote.
Yeah, I'll give my obligatory caveat that I think there are good arguments against 4 and 5, actually, honestly. 4, here's how I'm going to think about it. I'm going to imagine that I'm not in the Senate and I'm not in the House. Would I want Amendment 4 to be in the Missouri Constitution? And the answer is no. Because I think the process is pretty messed up. That's why I'm going through this gauntlet to try to affect change in it. I think there is heavy special interest control in the outcome of legislation, super heavy special interest control. And if the legislature gets too far away from the will of the people should have some way to circumvent them and to amend the Constitution, whether the Republicans are in charge or the Democrats are in charge. And I also think one day the Democrats will be in charge, and I may not like what they're doing. And I think I would like a way that if I got, you know, maybe 5/8 or 6/8 of congressional districts to override what the legislature did, that that should be available to me. And that us having a check on our power makes us more responsive to the people. So that's one issue that I think I've always been in favor of reforming the initiative petition process. Concurrent ratification, my friend Ron Calzone was a proponent of that. I concur with him. I think he really is the progenitor of that idea. I think that's the way to go. But I wasn't in favor of getting rid of the initiative petition process, which is, I think, is what we're doing. If you require all 8 districts to ratify in addition to a simple statewide majority, that means there's no more initiative petition process because no conservative IP is going to make it through the first district and no progressive IP is going to make it to the 8th district. There's also another problem, which is if the legislature refers, it's a simple majority to ratify into the Constitution. But if the people gather their signatures, you know, 8%, 5%, the last gubernatorial election, and those congressional districts, then it requires a simple majority and a ratification in every district. So it's much harder for the people to amend the Constitution, functionally impossible, but the standard for the legislature remains the same. And I think people don't like that. They feel like there's a big shift in power to the political class. And I'm not sure I would like that if I weren't in the legislature. So if I think about it from that point of view, then I vote no. And also I realize that puts me at odds with most of my conservative colleagues who I respect their opinion. Their opinion's not invalid that they think there's just too much getting to the Constitution and the things on the ballot are too serious not to stop. But also I would retort to them that let's say our Amendment 3 fails this year and there's gridlock in the legislature and there's no initiative petition process. That means you could do nothing about abortion if you're a citizen in the Constitution indefinitely. And so from a conservative's point of view, I don't think it's that great either.
Let's talk about Amendment 5 then. It would start the process of phasing out the income tax and replacing it with other taxes, lots of moving pieces yet to be determined. I do want your opinion on it, but I would like to bring up an ad that I see on this a lot that I want to help contextualize this. It's an ad of a very, very sweet older woman who talks about how she wants the government out of her piggy bank so that, and that they have to live on a budget, and that she wants more money to spend on her grandchildren. Isn't that just a bald-faced lie? Because Social Security income is not income taxed in Missouri. So if you are a senior citizen who wants to spoil grandchildren, you are now signing, you already have a very nice situation on the income tax side. But if you want to buy if you want to spoil your grandchildren by, you know, taking them to Chuck E. Cheese or buying them something at Walmart or something like that, all of those sales taxes are now going to go up. So isn't the rhetoric on this just straight up lying to people that you're going to not have to pay any income taxes, but there's going to be no repercussions for that?
So I guess I should say that the amendment doesn't require a raise on anything. The legislature could take no action, for one.
Just go bankrupt?
Well,
Kansas?
Well, not necessarily. There would be revenue triggers to remove the income tax. But I guess you could say the legislature will take no action either, and there won't be any, you know, there won't be any cuts or a sales tax increase. That's possible. So Amendment 5, so first of all, I'm just going to try to speak frankly about it, about my experience on it. I have knocked doors in every county in this district, in almost every city, and almost every subdivision. And I uniformly hear people who are antagonistic to Amendment 5. That, because you just mentioned at the very beginning of our interview that the cost of living is top of mind for people. Mm-hmm. And so Amendment 5 is directly coordinated to increasing the cost of living for people who have fixed income and lower income. And so they're like, hey, this is the legislature not only increasing my cost of living, but just like in Amendment 4, this is the legislature giving themselves sort of a unfettered power, unbridled power, without the constraints of, it's actually the Fernahan Amendment, I think, in 18 of the Constitution. But people would say, well, they'll describe it for the understanding as the Hancock Amendment, right? They're saying, hey, you know, the legislature's taking on this power. And that seems like people aren't buying it. And they're not buying it because of the phrase that says any goods or services could be taxed. So I, you know, my anticipation is that Amendment 5 will not pass just based on my experience. Mm-hmm. And it won't pass not just because Democrats are going to have a high turnout to vote no on it. It won't pass because Republicans are pretty split on it. And the Republican Party, as it got more populist, as it got more Trump Republican, it got more anti-billionaire Republican, right? Anti-establishment Republican. And it just doesn't seem like it's going to succeed on the ballot. The argument for eliminating the income tax has been that if there's a family that has, you know, extra $200 a month, they can apply it for their credit card, they could put it in their 401k, and over a decade, that creates this wealth that people can pass on, that creates opportunity, that allows people to make more control. And I still believe in that, that a lower tax burden allows people to escape poverty better, that people who are super rich, especially since we're limiting capital gains tax, they're not even really paying taxes right now. It's middle-income people and lower-income people, like how I started out low-income, who wanted to save and succeed and make a business, that sort of thing. And I want people to be able to do that. I think that's still important. But a big problem in the wording of Amendment 5 is the open-ended nature of what gets taxed. And I even hear conservatives say, this is a thing I probably hear every day, somebody say. They go, I'm all for getting rid of the income tax, but I don't know what you're going to do to replace it. I don't know what you're going to put a 17% sales tax on. Me getting my hair cut, me getting my oil changed, me walking down the street, walking my dog down the street. What do you know? How is it going to affect me personally? And since nobody knows that, that nebulousness is what probably is going to cause it to fail, I think. But there's an interesting, but so the nebulousness, I think, is caused by this. Because so if you went to go get your hair cut and the hairdresser paid 4.7% income tax and you replace that with, say, a 4.7% sales tax, you would have a equally net transaction cost, right? It wouldn't like increase the burden that the government puts on for the price. The producer can make the price whatever they want, but the taxes doesn't increase the price. And the reason why it can't be this like obvious one-for-one exchange is because the profit, so you pay income tax on a profit margin, not the gross receipt. You pay sales tax on a gross receipt, but income tax is paid on your net proceeds after your costs.
Well, in addition to that, the 4.7% tax on a haircut is paid by both the person who's trying to raise a family on $50,000 and the person who's raising a family on $500,000. They both pay that 4.7% tax on
right.
haircut.
That's a good point. But it's also true that if we made it a singular percentage, it'd be the same. If it's a 4% on everything, it'd be 4% on everything. But that's my point also. It won't be 4% on everything. Because some businesses have a 10% profit margin. Some businesses have a 1% profit margin. Some businesses have an 80% profit margin. And the government doesn't know and shouldn't know what the profit margin of any business is. But since the government has no idea, and I don't think they ever should, know exactly how much how much your differential is, right? Like, because that's how business works. You try to create an edge. And your edge, the differential, gives you profit, and that's what allows you to hire people. But that's why it's just incalculable. And so I think what'll happen is it'll fail. And I think that this issue will move on to other, we'll talk about data centers and stuff next session. We'll focus on that. And then one day we'll go back to the drawing board about comprehensive tax reform, which I think we need to get to eliminate these weird tax credits and stuff like these for corporations, I think.
Okay, just to be clear, because I looked at the roll call votes and you voted for an initial version of this bill or this constitutional amendment that was very different from the outcome, but you did not vote on final passage of what became Amendment 5.
Right.
So would you have voted yes to put it on the ballot? And are you voting yes or no on it as a private citizen? Because I think we're going to ask all the people that.
I know.
I think it's important for people to know the answer to both of those questions.
And I get that the other candidates are now no's on it. I might lose the election by saying that I still support the idea of getting rid of the income tax, but not the idea of raising sales taxes. And that's kind of where I am. And I think that's right. I think it's an opportunity to get rid of the income tax. But I wouldn't vote, and I think other people have said the same thing, I wouldn't vote to, you know, make their 17% on haircuts or whatever. I think there's other ways we can cut spending, find other revenue sources like other bills I've talked about, and try to address that. I think there does need to be comprehensive tax reform, though, like with property taxes and stuff like that. I did vote on the initial version. I was out of the state when it came back. I guess it was in April. I thought it would come back at the end of session for the Senate, but I was out of the state at the time. I was at a conference. So I kind of missed what the changes were and didn't have changes that I wanted. That's true. And I was out of state to see the final version. I could tell the people what I was advocating for in the initial version. I didn't want a sales tax on services. I wanted us to address personal property tax and property tax growth and just have kind of a comprehensive, here's how we're changing it. And I wanted people to kind of know where things would be paid for, how things were going to be paid for, how firefighters are going to be paid for, how education would be paid for. You know, that made it clear that if you're replacing a income tax with a 1% sales tax on Amazon products or something, that would make more sense to me. So, you know, those things, you know, weren't in the final bill. And it's hard to talk about because it's so unpopular, but I've always been a believer in no income tax. Because I think, this is my economic philosophy, that allows the most people to prosper. And you say, well, that's just for the rich people. No, I think the rich people have already prospered. I'm talking about allowing other people to become rich. That's what my policy's about. If you're poor, I was really poor growing up. You know, people say you're a lawyer, you know, you have these fancy Bill Hardwick t-shirts. I was really poor growing up. You know, like we were on food stamps. You know, dad got disabled. He couldn't work. You know, we didn't have a lot. Mom cleaned houses. So, you know, I started working when I was a teenager and kind of provided for myself since then. And so I always thought it'd be appreciative if you could. I always thought cash flow was always a big deal to me as somebody who did that. It always was a big deal to be like, I have an extra $100 and I could decide what I'm going to do with that extra $100. That was just ingrained in my mind that an extra $100 every month is like what, and I was always trying to get an extra $100 and I'd work extra jobs to get extra $100. So I had that mentality when I voted for it in the legislature. You know, I do have the mentality that we don't want to raise cost on people. I mean that, but that was kind of my thought process. That's where I was coming from, with somebody who's like, you know, cash flow accumulated over years and decades is what changes people's lives. So,
I guess my final question for you, we're kind of running low on time, and I would like to talk about data centers. I feel like we could spend an entire podcast on that. So I'll use my last question for that. I saw in one of your ads that you were fighting against the proliferation of these mega data centers everywhere, but it kind of feels that when I look at the Republican leadership, I look at people like Governor Kehoe and other folks, they're going in the exact opposite direction. And what I see coming down the pike is legislation that's going to make it very hard for local communities to regulate data centers and basically doing some sort of statewide standard similar to how you do for CAFOs. Is that what you're expecting too? If that's the case, like, isn't that going to make people angrier and feel that Jefferson City isn't listening to them, given that these have been primarily fought on a local level?
I think there will be legislation on data centers. I met a person in Lebanon on Saturday, and he came out and said, "Here's, I'd like to do something on data centers. Will you file a bill?" And I said, "Yeah, I'll file a bill on data centers." And I think I earned his support that way. And he's got my cell phone number. I've got his now. And he's going to follow up to make sure I do that and make sure that I address the problem. To your point about a lot of the Republican leadership is for data center development, I think that here's an argument for me to be a senator, somebody who really stands their ground and is resolute when they have a position, somebody who listens and thinks, but somebody who's respectful and doesn't call names. I think you can disagree with the governor and still say he's trying to do what's best for the state, but I don't think that's right. And as a senator, I'm going to say, okay, we're going to have a real different direction policy position. So I'm listening to what the people in this area want and what I believe in, because I believe that not only there are environmental questions that aren't being answered or energy bill questions that aren't being answered, there's the artificial intelligence surveillance state that's on the horizon that I think is a big problem for human dignity and freedom. And I want to do something about that. So those are real concerns that I have. I feel like, you know, for such a time as this, we got to address those concerns. But that means I can disagree with colleagues without being hateful or calling them names or impugning their motives. That would be a real difference for me. And that's actually why I think I've been effective, even the VLT issue, why I've been so effective. I'm about thinking about it and trying to figure it out and sticking to my principles without being vicious personally to people. That's what we lost, and that's how I think we should tackle it. We should you know, we should seek wisdom on the issue. We should be true to our word. We promised our constituents the campaign trail, and we should do that in a diligent way, an intelligent way. And then we should be statesmen about it too. And I'm trying to imbue all of those qualities on that issue.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today. And we will have Politically Speaking podcasts with other major Republican candidates running for the 16th Senatorial District. You can find all of our coverage of the 2026 August 4th primary by going to stlpr.org. Politically Speaking is a product of St. Louis Public Radio, which is part of the University of Missouri system. And Representative, how can people find out more about your campaign on the World Wide Web?
They can just email me. I've had the same email for forever. Captain Kirk Rules at the Z underscore 2001 A Space Odysseus at AOL.com.
Wow. That's the best answer I've heard of that question, Representative. Thank you so much. And until next time, so long.
Politically Speaking is produced by Sarah Kellogg, Rachel Lipman, and me, Jason Rosenbaum. The show is edited by Fred Ehrlich. Read all of our coverage at stlpr.org. And if you haven't already, make sure to subscribe to Politically Speaking by searching the term Politically Speaking on Apple Podcasts. From St. Louis Public Radio. This is Politically Speaking.